Hello and welcome to Paradox Podcast, episode 53. This one is entitled The Monotony of Love. And we have been on a quest through the book Song of Solomon. And today we're looking at Song of Solomon chapter 5. But in order for us to talk about what happens in Song of Solomon chapter 5, it's important for us to remember where we have come from. In the first episode of this series, we talked about the uniqueness of Song of Solomon because it's written from a black woman's perspective, which we just don't find much of within the Bible. And so in Song of Solomon chapter 1, she says, "I am black and beautiful." And we talked about how part of the human journey is making peace with who God created us to be. The next episode, we talked about this phrase that this woman utters, which is, "My beloved is mine and I am his." And we talked about how she said this at a time when women were viewed as something to be owned. And so this phrase, "My beloved is mine and I am his," revealed that love is as uncompromisingly selfish as it is recklessly selfless. And then during the last episode, we highlighted the Song of Solomon 5:1, which says, "Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love." And we talked about how God created us to live in an overflowing excess of love. And these words, "eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love," is after this couple has been married and after they have made love. And the truth is, when we talk about stories in our modern era, most stories end here. Most movies end here, where a couple has fallen in love and they live happily ever after. Now, I am a father of a 3-year-old daughter, which means that there are a lot of Disney princesses in my house. And when you think about where most of the movies end, they all kind of end in the same place. When you talk about The Little Mermaid, you talk about Ariel and Eric getting married at the end, and the credits roll, and the assumption is that they live happily ever after. When you think of Aladdin, which was nominated for a Best Picture at one point, Aladdin and Jasmine get married, they fly off on a magic carpet because that's romantic, and there's fireworks in the background, and then the credits begin to roll, and we assume that they live happily ever after. In The Princess and the Frog, which was the last hand-drawn Disney film, Naveen and Tiana get married, the last scene is their wedding scene, they kiss, and then the credits roll, and we assume that they live happily ever after. So when this couple falls in love and gets married, and then they make love, which is left out of the Disney movies, obviously, we assume that they just will roll the credits and they'll end the movie, because most movies that we know end here. "Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love." What a great note to end on. But the shocking part about Song of Solomon is that it's only halfway done. That comes at the end of chapter 4. And there are 8 chapters total. So with that in mind, let's read Song of Solomon 5:2 to 5:8 and hear about what happens shortly after the happily ever after. Now this passage begins with the woman speaking. She says, "I slept, but my heart was awake." Now what's interesting about that phrase, "I slept, but my heart was awake," is that she instantly begins to tell us about a dream that she had. "I slept, but my heart was awake." And so the things that happen now after she has fallen in love and after she has gotten married, she is now telling what happens afterwards through a vision in a dream. So she says, "I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, my beloved is knocking." So she's in her bedroom and there is someone knocking at the door. It is her beloved. And he says to her, "Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night." She then responds by saying, "I had put off my garment. How could I put it on again? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? My beloved thrust his hand into the opening and my inmost being yearned for him. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh upon the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and was gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but did not find him. I called him, but he gave no answer." So now the woman who was in her bedroom and says, "I cannot be bothered," rushes to the door, opens the door, her beloved is gone, and she goes out into the night of Jerusalem to find her beloved. Verse 7 then says, "Making the rounds in the city, the sentinels found me, They beat me. They wounded me. They took away my mantle, those sentinels at the wall. Now, this is very jarring language because one of the worst sins on earth is domestic abuse. And so we read about this woman being beaten by men and we are appalled and we are shocked and we are thrown off of what this dream is. But I think that what this woman is trying to talk about is she's trying to talk about this happened in a dream. And so this wasn't really a historical event. It was part of the dream. And she goes out looking for her lover. The sentinels, the watchmen of the city, find her. They beat her. And in response, in verse 8, she says, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him this, I am faint with love." Now, this all seems very strange. I mean, you've got the domestic abuse. You've got, this lover knocking on the door. You've got her giving this weird excuse. And it's all in a dream. And the question becomes, well, what is Song of Solomon chapter 5 really all about? And I think it's really important for us to key in on the opening, which is the beloved is at the door. He is knocking and he says, "Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night." Now, if you just read this verse by itself, it doesn't really mean much. But if you've been with us for the past 4 weeks, you know that this means a lot because this woman and this man have expressed over and over again the desire and the love and the passion they share for one another. So we know that this woman cares deeply about this man, and we know that this man cares deeply about this woman. And so he shows up in the dead of night. Presumably he's been out working, and he comes back early. He goes, travels through the night. He gets to the door of his beloved because he can't wait to see her. He knocks on the door, and he says, "Open to me, my darling, my love." And she responds by saying, "I had put off my garment. How could I put it on again? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them?" In other words, she says, "Do you really have to bother me right now?" This is shocking because this woman has professed her love for this man over and over again over the past 4 chapters. And now he shows up and she's like, "Not interested. I'm kind of tired. I'm sleepy." So when we have this question, what is Song of Solomon chapter 5 about? I think the answer is what once was valued is now taken for granted. What once was loved is now mundane. What once was beautiful is now ordinary. Now, throughout church history, men have controlled the pulpit. And so men have often looked at women and held up this chapter and said, "Women, you have a tendency to take your man for granted." And men do this because there's this understanding that this woman represents all of womanhood and this man represents all of manhood. But the truth is, men take women for granted just as often, if not more so, as women do within romantic relationships. And I think all of us, whether we are men or women, can identify with this story in Song of Solomon chapter 5, which is about what once was valued has now been taken for granted. And when I think of these Disney movies and how they idealize love and they lived happily ever after, Disney movies don't do this lesson so well, which is what once was valued is now taken for granted. They rarely get into that kind of story because it's complicated and it's messy and it's two human beings and they're hard to describe and to simplify into a cartoon. But we love the Disney movies, and it's not just Disney movies. We love the romantic comedies. We love the stories where a couple falls in love and we assume they live happily ever after. Song of Solomon chapter 5 comes along and it's jarring because it's so different than all of that. And when I think about our society and how we portray love and how we portray our stories and movies, we so often like to think of love as similar to a gold medal, in that you work hard, you're passionate, and once you search and you search and you search and you find that special one, the one, you ask them to marry you, he asks you to marry you, whatever it is, and all of a sudden once you're married, you've got the gold medal, and for the rest of your life, you're known as gold medalist Simone Biles, or you're known as Mr. and Mrs. Carter, or Mr. and Mrs. Hadley, or Mr. and Mrs. Smith. our society and our society's stories love to portray love as a gold medal. Now, of course, it'd be strange if you had a TV show where you handed out gold medals to couples that fell in love. But it would not be so strange to have a TV show where instead of handing out gold medals, you handed out roses to a couple that fell in love, which is why we have The Bachelor on ABC, and it's like 98th season or whatever it's been. It seems like it's been on forever, right? And I'm sure there's a lot of fans of The Bachelor that listen to this podcast, and I have to say welcome. We're glad that you're here. And while we love to make fun of The Bachelor because it doesn't have a very high success rate, Bachelor Nation does love the success stories, and, you know, I kind of love the success stories too. One of the most famous success stories in Bachelor history was Sean Lowe and his wife, Catherine, who fell in love in 2012 on the show. He proposed to her. They got married on live TV in 2014, and now they are still married 2 years later, and they have an adorable son. And I see these pictures of Catherine and Sean and their son together, and I just say to myself, I cannot wait till that son grows up and turns to his mom and dad and says, Mom, Dad, how'd you guys meet? I picture Sean saying to his son, well, let me tell you, son. And he goes to the closet and he pulls out a picture from the first night of The Bachelor. He says, here's a picture of when your mom and I met. And it's Sean. Catherine is just the face of the crowd. And there's like 25 other girls. And I picture the son saying, well, tell me what it was like to propose to Mom. And Sean says, oh, it was one of the most romantic and heartbreaking days of my life. And the son says, why was it heartbreaking? And Sean said, well, I had to dump my other girlfriend first before I proposed to your mom because, you know, that's the way The Bachelor works. And Catherine and Sean, I have no doubt, you know, I love to laugh a little bit about The Bachelor, but I'm not here to say that their marriage is bad or that it's artificial because it's on TV. I think they are in love and I wish them well and I want them to succeed and I want their marriage to be a good marriage because why wouldn't I? But they got married on January 26, 2014. And what was interesting about that date is they aired their wedding on live TV on ABC. And less than a month later, on February 25, 2014, The Bachelor was in the middle of their fantasy suite episodes, which is just, I mean, you just have to see it to believe it. But the fantasy suite episode is when you're down to the final three contestants, and it was three girls and one bachelor choosing between the three of them. And less than a month after his wedding, Sean Lowe decided to tweet about the Bachelor with the hashtag fantasy suite. Now, the picture that he tweeted was a picture of him and Catherine sitting on a bed. He's looking directly at the camera with a sarcastic look in his eye. And Catherine is just a few feet away from him, completely uninterested in him, and completely absorbed in her phone. And the tweet, the words that he used to describe this picture was, "This is what you're competing for, girls." And Catherine couldn't look more bored than the fact that she had won The Bachelor and she was laying and sharing a bed with the man that she had fought so aggressively for just 2 years ago on The Bachelor. And I look at this picture of a married couple looking absolutely bored just a month after their wedding. And I have to ask the question, what happened? What happened? You guys won the gold medal. You got the final rose. You guys should be just so head over heels, romantically, passionately in love. And you look bored out of your mind. And I think there's a real problem when we portray love as a gold medal. Because love doesn't work that way. A much better metaphor for what love is love is like a garden. A garden. Now, when I think of a garden, I think of the most beautiful garden in the world, which is in Kyoto, Japan. And the garden's name is Katsura Imperial Villa. I went to this a few years ago, and it is just, I can't describe to you how sublime the gardens of Kyoto are. And I remember walking through the grounds and just being overwhelmed by the serenity of this garden and thinking to myself, man, this garden must take a lot of energy. And I started thinking to myself, what happens if the gardeners don't show up tomorrow? Like, what would this place look like? Well, I probably wouldn't be able to tell a difference because I'm not like a huge gardening connoisseur. But I, if the gardeners didn't show up for an entire week, I have a feeling that I would be able to tell a difference. Things wouldn't be quite as precise, quite as trim. A few things would be overgrown, and the place would look a little less stunning. But imagine if the gardeners didn't show up for a month, or a year, or 5 years. The garden wouldn't really be a garden anymore. It would just be overgrown greenery. It would just be another green spot on the map rather than being one of the most sublime, beautiful experiences on the planet. And so love is like a garden because over time, a garden's natural native trajectory is to sour into the mundane. A garden that is left alone will overgrow itself into being no longer a garden. In the same way, over time, love's natural native trajectory is to sour into monotony. And so when we look at this tweet of Sean and Catherine on a bed and it says, "This is what you're competing for, girls." I think it was a joke. I really do. I'm sure their marriage is fine. And I don't want to say that that looks terrible. But imagine if that picture was every night of their marriage, where as soon as they got to bed, they both looked at their phones every night and they just kind of lived in parallel lives to one another. That doesn't look like romance or love. It looks like a living hell. And what it is two people refusing to do work to prevent the marriage from souring into monotony. The great comedian Louis C.K. talked about how love's natural native trajectory is to sour into monotony probably better than anyone in his special Chewed Up from 2008. In that special, he said, "My wife and I, we've been married for about 9 years now, so we're almost done." He says, "After 9 years and two kids, you start looking at each other like, no, we're not just going to keep doing this. Who would do that?" So we went to therapy for a while, and therapist is like, "You should go on a date." And I'm like, "Screw you." And what Louis C.K. gives a window to, just like he does throughout his career, is he's so honest because he shows that over time, love's natural native trajectory is to sour into monotony. And when we look at the story of this woman and this man that were at one point so head over heels in love in Song of Solomon, and we read this story about what once was valued is now taken for granted, we have to say, oh, of course it is. Because what Song of Solomon 5 is telling us is that over time, love's natural native trajectory is to sour into monotony. And when this woman says to her husband that she loves, "Oh, my garment's off and my feet are clean. I don't want to get my feet dirty." She rushes to the door. She catches herself. She says, "Oh my goodness, I've taken this marriage for granted." And in this dream, she rushes to the door and he's gone. And she says these words in Song of Solomon 5:6, "My soul failed me when he spoke before." And if you look at the phrase, the Hebrew words behind that, the phrase for "my soul failed me," it's the Hebrew phrase nafshi yetzah, which a literal translation is "my soul went out." So she is saying, "I was soulless when I heard my lover spoke." Oh my goodness, what powerful, inspired, and timeless words those are. So this woman is out in the midst of Jerusalem. She has gone out. She has been beaten. She has felt pain trying to find her love again. And she says, if any of you daughters of Jerusalem see my lover, tell him I am faint with love. Tell him I miss him. Tell him that I want him to come back. And what's interesting is in Song of Solomon 5:9 is the daughters of Jerusalem who hear this request respond to her. And they say to her, "What is your beloved more than another beloved, O fairest among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved that you adjure us?" In other words, they say, "What's so special about this man? I mean, doesn't everybody fall in love? Why should we worry about you finding this man when there's plenty of fish in the sea?" And you can almost feel this woman tensing up because she's just been told that her husband is an ordinary man, a run-of-the-mill guy, and that she just kind of settled for any man and she might as well just settle for another one. And so she tenses up. She says, "You want to know why my man is special?" And in verse 10, she begins to explain what sets this man that she has fallen in love with apart from all other men. In verse 10, she says, "My beloved is all radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside springs of water, bathed in milk, fitly set. His cheeks are like beds of spices, yielding fragrance. His lips are lilies, distilling liquid myrrh. His arms are rounded gold, set with jewels. His body is ivory work, encrusted with sapphires." Tell me that isn't amazing. His body is ivory work, encrusted with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns set upon bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His speech is most sweet, and he is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. If I could paraphrase Song of Solomon 5:10-16 in two words, she basically turns to the daughters of Jerusalem who say that she is married to an ordinary man, and she basically says, "Screw you." And so this woman, who at one point took this love for granted, turns to the daughters of Jerusalem and conquers this monotony, conquers love's natural native trajectory, by expressing gratitude for the fact that she is in love with no ordinary man, but an extraordinary man. And so what this woman reveals is that while love is like a garden, the gardening that we put into the romantic relationships that we have is gratitude. Now you may say, "Craig, you're overemphasizing gratitude. Like, gratitude can't really be the key to avoid monotony, right?" Well, I would refer you to one of my great heroes in my life, a man named Fritz Guy, who's a professor at La Sierra University, where I did my master's degree. And my last class with him was a directed study, so it was just me and him. And it was this class on suffering and trying to understand it in the midst of the world and spirituality. And during that class, he told me these words. He said, "The greatest indicator of spiritual maturity is gratitude." It's not correct belief. It's not religious worship attendance. It is not the memorization of the Bible. It is the ability to say thank you for the life you have been given. Now, before I go any further, I understand I wrote this during Black History Month, and I understand that there's a real danger because white people have used scripture and religion and religious teachings to oppress women, people of color, and people of other sexual orientations and genders. And there's a sense that if I were to stand up here and say the greatest indicator of spiritual maturity is gratitude, it could be perceived as a white man saying to everyone else who's less privileged than me that they should be grateful for what they have and not cause conflict. That is not what Fritz Guy was saying, and that's not what I am saying to you right now. I think of James Cone, who wrote The Cross and Lynching Tree, one of the great civil rights authors of our lifetime. And in that book, he speaks about spiritual maturity, and he says, "The transcendent and the imminent, heaven and earth, must be held together in critical dialectical tension, each one correcting the limits of the other." And so I think Fritz Guy would agree with that and say, yes, and the goal is to be thankful for heaven and the transcendent and to continue to work toward fostering that heaven in fighting for civil rights with a heart of gratitude toward God. And I believe that James Cone would agree with Fritz Guy because the greatest indicator of spiritual maturity is gratitude. So I hear this story of this woman who conquers monotony by expressing gratitude. And I think about funerals and the tragedy of going to funerals and how we sit in remembrance of someone we loved who has been lost. And if the death is a sudden death, so often as a pastor, I hear a phrase pop up at numerous funerals. And it comes from people standing next to the casket who lean over to a loved one and say, "I just wish I would have told them how much they meant to me." Now, that's a tragic statement because it expresses regret. And it expresses that there wasn't enough gratitude expressed while this person was alive. And there was this sense that this life that is no longer with them was taken for granted. And what I think that phrase exposes, I just wish I would have told them how much they meant to me, is that we conquer monotony by regularly practicing gratitude. And so when we talk about the greatest indicator of spiritual maturity is gratitude, we as spiritual people should be really good at harboring gratitude. Now, there are two kinds of gratitude that we practice. One is the spontaneous gratitude where you're caught by surprise and all of a sudden you're overwhelmed by how grateful you are to be alive. And the truth is you can't really plan those, but they are beautiful when they happen and they burst in like a song and you just have to sing along. But then there's a second type of gratitude, and that is a regular habitual practice of gratitude. It's a ritual of gratitude. And if we believe Fritz Guy that the greatest indicator of spiritual maturity is gratitude, then we as spiritual people should be really good at our rituals of gratitude. So I'd like to close by asking you a question. What are your rituals of gratitude? Because if we are to grow in gratitude, because that is what spiritual maturity is, what are we regularly practicing and controlling and doing to remind ourselves that we are grateful and that this life and this love isn't actually monotonous? When I think of rituals of gratitude, the first one that comes to mind is probably the most common, and that is when we pray before a meal. And throughout American culture and American history, this idea of saying grace before meals is highly depicted and highly known, and it's not really strange when people do this often in restaurants or in the home before Thanksgiving or before Christmas dinner. But there's a big difference between a ritual and an obligation. An obligation is a requirement that you do. A ritual is an expression of gratitude that you are grateful to partake in. Now, some people may think it's hard to tell the difference between a ritual and an obligation, but it's very simple. All you do is you ask the question why. So when it comes to this ritual of saying grace before a meal, at some point in your life, you should stop and say, why do we pray before every meal? And if the answer is, well, we just always done it, I would encourage you to just stop doing it. Stop doing that because it's an obligation and it's not helping anybody or anything. But if your response to the question, why do we pray before every meal, is something like this, well, it is a gift to be alive, and every time I put something in my mouth, it at one point was living. And so I am receiving something because something else gave, and I am in this cycle of receiving and giving, and I am grateful to receive while at other times I give. And this ritual of saying prayer before a meal reminds me that I must be grateful. Then I would encourage everyone who has that answer to continue to pray before meals. Another ritual that church people are familiar with is the ritual of communion. Now, communion is when Christians partake in bread and wine or grape juice, and it represents the blood and the body of Christ. And if you were to ask a Christian, why do you do this? Some Christians will respond, well, it's that time of the year. We do this four times a year, and it's that time of the year, so that's why we're doing it. That's an obligation. But if you respond by saying, the body and the blood that I possess is the same as Jesus Christ, and it is a gift to be made in God's image, and we eat the same bread in community, because it reminds us that we are all one in the body of Christ. That is a ritual that propels you to gratitude. And that is growing in your spiritual maturity. Another ritual of gratitude is one I just noticed recently, and it involves one of my favorite bands, the band Coldplay. Now, Coldplay, I got to see last summer at the Rose Bowl, and it was quite an experience. But something that surprised me was the second song they played in their set was a song called Yellow. And I first heard Yellow on a bus during my freshman year of high school. And that was a long time ago. And I thought to myself as they came out and played this song yet again, I thought to myself, I wonder if this ever gets old. And just a few days after this concert, they were playing in Dallas. They were playing AT&T Stadium, which you know you're a big deal when you're playing AT&T Stadium, the home of the Dallas Cowboys. And they posted a video of the band right before they went out on stage. And then they give the signal and the band goes out on stage. And right before they hit the stage, the lead singer, Chris Martin, bends down and kisses the stage. I couldn't believe it. I was shocked by it because it was such an overt move. And I don't know if he intended people to see it or not, but I Googled it shortly after that and not many people talked about it. However, shortly after that, he was playing Glastonbury and he did the same thing and NME picked it up. And I realized that this was something that he did regularly. And as you can imagine, playing the same song year after year after year after year would probably get monotonous without the regular practice of gratitude. And the way that Chris Martin battles this monotony is he regularly practices gratitude. And he has this ritual of kissing the stage before he plays as a way to remind him that this is love and that it should not be taken for granted. Another ritual is by one of my favorite authors, a man named Rob Bell. In his book, How to Be Here, he talks about the strange tradition that we have of couples when they register for their wedding gifts to register for two sets of plates. One is your everyday plates, and the other plates are the very expensive, very nice, fine china. And he said, isn't it strange that you spend all this money on the nice plates and you rarely use them? And so he starts talking about how he became more and more aware that it was more and more important to become present and not take his kids and his wife for granted. And so he said he started making breakfast on a regular basis with smoothies and bacon and eggs. And so in his book, How to Be Here, he says, if you were to come over to our house for breakfast, we would eat breakfast and go all out. And we'd eat it all on the fine china every morning. And if you were to ask me why we're eating on the fine china for just a regular Tuesday, I would say to you, all we have is today. My word, all we have is today, he would say. And it is worth celebrating. Later in that chapter, he says, find your rituals, develop your routines, create those practices that ground and center you. Stick to them. Don't apologize to them. Treat them, even the small things, like they're big things. Which brings us to another ritual. Because every week I meet with seven other people and we sit down to talk about this sermon. So that way I have more of an understanding and more perspective as I write these words. And so seven other people write these sermons with me. So we meet at two church members' house. Their names are Olivia and Kahari. And we went over to their house this past Wednesday. And we knock on the door, they open the door, and we're shocked because inside is all sorts of streamers. And we say, oh, wow, you guys are really excited about our sermon study group. And Kahari said, well, no, it's for my birthday. And I said, it's your birthday today and you're here at the sermon study group? That's amazing. He said, well, no, it's not today. It's on Sunday. And in my head, I start thinking like, why are there streamers set up for Sunday when it's Wednesday? And so I try my best to gently ask or gently comment, well, that's really looking ahead and being prepared. And Olivia says, yeah, we really look forward to Kahari's birthday. And I say, why is that? And Olivia gets really serious and she says, well, we were married a few years ago and it was a wonderful ceremony. We had a great time. But 10 months after we were married, Kahari started feeling chest pain. And so we rushed him to the hospital and the doctors told us that he was at risk for sudden death and his heart could give out at any moment. And she said, for 5 agonizing days, I was in the hospital and I was terrified. I was scared to go to the bathroom because I might be witnessing the last moments of my husband's life. And she said after 5 days, they stabilized the heart condition. They sent us home. And shortly after that, I realized it was Kahari's birthday soon. And she said, I almost lost him. So we decided we were going to go all out for his birthday. And every year since then we have, because we're not sure we're going to have another one. And so we might as well celebrate to our fullest capacity now. And so she said, every year now we look forward to the birthday because we're so grateful to have this time together. So Kahari's birthday is a ritual of gratitude. A ritual of gratitude. How often do we look at birthday parties and say, oh, we got to plan another one, or, oh, a birthday's coming up, I got to get a gift. That's an obligation. But a birthday is the perfect ritual of gratitude, as long as you're willing to put the time in to have it be an expression of love. Which brings us to our last ritual of gratitude I'd like to share with you this podcast. And this ritual involves a band known as Radiohead. And back in 1994, this band wrote the greatest love song of all time. They wrote a song called Fake Plastic Trees. And if you're wondering what lyrics are held in the greatest love song of all time, I will tell you. The lyrics are a green plastic watering can for her fake Chinese rubber plants in fake plastic earth. And you may say, well, that's strange words for the greatest love song of all time. That's strange words for any song. Who on earth would buy that song? I will tell you, a lot of people will buy that song. A lot of people. So Radiohead wrote, produced, and recorded this song, Fake Plastic Trees, in 1994. 15 years later, on the other side of the world, in a church parking lot, there was an incredibly awkward guy and an incredibly beautiful woman sitting in a car in a church parking lot. And these two young kids had just decided to become boyfriend and girlfriend. And the girl's name was Kimberly, and I was the awkward man. Now, in that car, we were talking. And I realized that this woman was, in fact, amazing. Just otherworldly, like just indescribable how wonderful this woman was. And we were talking. She was laughing at my jokes. She was telling me stories that were fascinating. And the minutes just slipped by at a rapid pace. And then all of a sudden, this song came on the radio. And we just stopped talking.
The green plastic watering can. For a fake Chinese rubber plant and a fake plastic girl.
And I remember sitting there in that car so long ago and thinking to myself, what if this actually works out? What if I say I love you to this woman? What if she says it back? What if I get down on one knee at one point in my life and say, Kimmy, will you marry me? What if we get married? What if we have kids? What if this woman is the one? And I just sat there in that moment, just being overwhelmed by this song, and the song ended, and it felt like it was way too short. And right after it ended, my wife turned to me, or my girlfriend at the time turned to me, and she said, that should be our song. And because I was just so drunk with love, I said, sure, babe, whatever, that's wonderful. And I never thought to look at the lyrics, and she never thought to look at the lyrics, and it didn't matter because the lyrics didn't really matter. It described that moment. And so throughout our dating, that was our song. And whenever that song would come on, we would dance and we would kiss and we would smile, as we remembered what it was like to be that young couple that barely knew each other back in that car. Well, a few months after that, I proposed to Kimmy at the Salk Institute in San Diego, and then we got married in Redlands, California. And at the wedding, we asked Jeff Pettis to sing that song, Fake Plastic Trees, at our wedding. And we've now been married for 6 years and we have two kids. In other words, all of the dreams that I had in that car as that song played have come true. And guess what we do whenever that song comes on the radio or whenever it comes on our iTunes shuffle? We stop what we're doing. We hug, we dance, and we kiss as we realize we are living our dreams. Now, I do not tell you all of this to brag to you. I tell you all of this because when we ask the question, what does it mean for a couple to have a song? It's a ritual. It's a ritual of gratitude. And for a couple to have a song may or may not work for every couple. And I'm not saying you've got to do that as much as you've got to harbor and develop your rituals of gratitude. Because I will tell you, in the midst of all of this joy of being married to this wonderful woman and being the parent of these two wonderful kids, there are days I take it for granted. There are stretches where I wish it wasn't so. And the thing I have to remind myself is that we conquer monotony by regularly practicing gratitude. And this song, Fake Plastic Trees, is just one of the many ways that we do that. But we as a people must become experts in developing these rituals of gratitude. What are your rituals of gratitude? Because remember, the greatest indicator of spiritual maturity is, in fact, gratitude. May you, my brothers and sisters, become people of gratitude. May you find your rituals of gratitude and shelter them, harbor them, practice them, so that you become people overflowing with appreciation for this life that God has given you. May you find grace and peace in all of your lives.
If I could be who you wanted, oh.